today on Movie World as we talk about War for the Planet of the Apes, Wish Upon, and Dunkirk. It's time for Movie Wallers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, as well.
Movie Wallers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, on streaming, or in the back of an airplane. You love the movies, this show is for you. I think I tripped over my words again, didn't I?
Yeah.
Ugh.
You know why?
Go on.
Because it's the middle of the night. You just to talk about Dunkirk. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
It's ridiculous to make someone get up in the middle of the night just to talk about Chris Nolan.
Not that I ever do that to you, Rashmi.
And you know how much I hate Nolan. And you would still do that to me. I don't hate him. I just think he's...
Just to correct perceptions here, listeners, yes. It is 8 p.m. Nobody got woken up for this podcast. It might be difficult to stay awake through this podcast because I think we've got a lot to say, especially at one of the movies. But... kind of excited to talk about all three of these,
really?
To be honest. Well,
really? Yeah.
Well, maybe two out of three. Guess which one I'm not excited about. So why don't we just jump into our reviews?
Let's
because
jump
this
in.
Is going to be one of those long shows. I've got a feeling somehow. So three movies to choose from. We're going to have War of the Planet of the Apes, Wish Upon, and Dunkirk. Should we do it in that order?
Sure.
All right. So War for the Planet of the Apes, is that my intro? Okay, so this is the third in the most recent iteration of Planet of the Apes. We had the original Charlton Heston one, then we had the one that we'd rather forget, starring Marky Mark back in 2000.
I kept thinking it was Matt LeBlanc. I think maybe he was in it.
I think it was Marky Mark, right?
It was
Marky
Mark.
Mark. Okay.
And then we had this most recent iteration. I think they began around 2011 with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I think. Mm-hmm. And this is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Rise, and now War for the Planet of the Apes. So this is the third in the trilogy. And I'll read the first couple of sentences of the movie synopsis. So in the War for the Planet of the Apes, the third chapter of the critically acclaimed blockbuster franchise, Caesar and his apes are forced into deadly conflict with an army of humans led by a ruthless colonel. After the apes suffer unimaginable losses, Caesar wrestles with his darker instincts and begins his own mythic quest to avenge his kind. I'll leave it there. So, I don't know about you guys, but I really, really liked the Rise Planet of the Apes, the Dawn. It was kind of good. It's sci-fi, but the last movie I thought was a terrific entry, so I had really high hopes for this one. What about you guys?
So I didn't love the second one. I like Dawn because it was something new, and it was, I think, a new way of showing the origin of the Planet of the Apes, because normally we don't often get that origin. So I like Dawn. I did not like Rise, but this one is one of the most magnificent movies I've ever watched. I don't know how else to describe it other than magnificent. This is epic in scale and by far the best ape movie, I think. I think the genius of the movie for me is that you could replace the apes with any group of people who are designated as terrorists, and I don't want to get political, but, you know, this could be like the rebel forces in Syria, and then the mess that ensues when different factions start to worry about wiping them out or killing them off or being scared for their own lives. And I think we stop understanding who the real bad guys are. So for me, this was just magnificent. I felt speechless when we left the cinema.
Yes, Lee.
So in my early 20s, I tried to read Catch 22 because everybody kept telling me that, you know, Catch 22, you have to read it. And ever since then, I've tried every 5, 6, 7, 8 years to read it, and I just can't get past like half the book. I just cannot. Like no part of it resonates for me. And I know that there's something inherently wrong with my wiring, which prevents me from, because it's an acknowledged classic. Everybody quotes it. It's going to be a book which lasts forever. And I just don't get it. And I have a similar feeling for this whole Apes franchise. I mean, it's beautiful to, I mean, the whole movie, this one, this third one in particular, the whole movie is CGI. And for once, you don't feel like it's CGI. There isn't a second in it where it doesn't feel anything more than absolutely real. But those apes just don't do anything for me. And I feel only personally responsible for it because I know these movies are greatly admired, venerated. I have nothing against them. It's visually just stupendous. But it didn't do anything for me. I was kind of waiting for it to end. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah, it's so bizarre.
Joe.
Maybe I was having a bad day. But no, I mean, in general, all three movies don't. I mean, I appreciate them. But yeah, they don't
trip your trigger.
Yeah, they don't inspire any passion. It's and I again, it's 100% my fault. It's my wiring. Joe, what's your wiring like?
I've been a huge fan of this franchise. I think I like the potential that was in the first movie, and the second movie really should have been called War, because I felt like that was a battle movie, and I really enjoy those kind of things. This one is a much more thoughtful, cerebral, personal movie. I say personal in the sense of it's very much about the character of Caesar. And much more so in some ways than the other movies were, because I think that the first one was a good sci-fi blash. The last one, as I said, was, you know, this big kind of clash of cultures, this battle movie. This one is a monkey's journey. And, consequently, I admired it like you did, Yazdi, but it didn't rouse me in the way that the second movie did. It didn't get me excited, and I found it, almost a little tiresome. I think it could have done with a little editing, just to kind of tighten it up a bit, because it felt a little ponderous to me, which is sad because I think there was a lot to admire here. Andy Serkis, oh my God, we have to talk about like the mocap that they've done here. And I watched a few YouTube videos actually, behind the scenes on his craft and how he brings, you know, Caesar the ape to life. But, it's a movie that I admired rather than enjoyed, and I'm really sad because it's reviewed ridiculously well, but it just felt just a little too obvious to me.
Really?
Yeah, I think it felt all along the way. I knew that I knew the story arc of Caesar from the beginning. It kind of was all there to see.
I mean, I didn't see an obvious arc. I mean, for me, it just poses such an existential question regarding what makes us human. So again, it goes into sort of, is it the ability to talk or the acts that we engage in, or at a more holistic level, you know, right versus wrong when one's consumed by rage? And just the emotionality of it was incredible on so many levels. And I think it tackles those issues of loss and survival and duty. And then this whole beautiful relationship between species, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it that binds us together? And that just got under my skin. And maybe it's because I love animals. I don't know. But, you know, I often think, like, if our animals could talk, what would they be telling me? Probably to stop molesting them. but just that whole sense of when you have animals that talk, what is it? What is it to be human?
Well, yeah, I mean, do you really think of them as animals in this movie? I mean, I think they're more human. It's the humanity within them that the
correct.
Movie, the whole franchise
made of
is about.
Stone.
I am clearly. I mean, I can understand intellectually the movie is asking some big questions. I think it's it is its intent to ask a lot of big questions. But like you, Joseph, I could kind of see through it. I mean, I understand that it's very difficult to ask these questions in a movie's primary purpose is to entertain and be a big, you know, summer blockbuster. So I give it kudos for that. But I saw kind of very obvious, homages to like Apocalypse Now. I saw a little bit of The Lion King, even Full Metal Jacket. So, but it's at its core, it's about any kind of a disenfranchised group which is battling for its rights and its survival. I can see that. I can totally see that.
Mm-hmm.
But
which is relevant to now.
Yes,
I mean, it's super smart in the way that it does that.
But is it? I mean, I think for me, it was all too conveniently plotted. And I think I struggled with... it's really hard to... I want to dodge around spoilers here, but I'll speak in a way that hopefully doesn't spoil the movie for those who haven't seen it. I struggled with the convenience factor of when Caesar is captured. You know, when you have warring factions like this, wouldn't the first thing you do be to execute the leader? You know, I don't know. I struggled with how he was caught to be. You knew that he was going to prevail, and so it just felt awkwardly plotted to me.
So let me answer that. I think it would be the end of the movie if he was caught and killed, right? So let's put that aside. I think there are two ways that someone who is insecure can claim they are the leader or the supreme leader, and that is either by killing his greatest enemy or by making his greatest enemy succumb to him.
I believe that's where it's trying to go. And a lot of movies do that. But I think
that shows more about the baddie than
sure. Caesar. A lot of movies do that, but I think the sleight of hand can be more effective. You know, I think... Here and maybe it's the fact that we know that the Planet of the Apes legend ends with apes ruling the Earth. You know, that is ultimately the end that this whole trilogy has been getting us to, right? It's how did the apes overtake the Earth so that when Charlton Heston lands on a planet in a couple of hundred years' time, you know, he thinks he's on a foreign planet and he turns out to be Earth. You know, that big twist.
You just gave it away.
I think statute of limitations for a 1967 film has expired, so I'll give that one. But maybe it was that just kind of I knew that I had this inherent sense that the apes would prevail.
Yeah, but I think so you can say the apes will prevail, but I think what's smart is that the apes prevail because the humans are so stupid and self-absorbed. And so I think there is the tale, right? I think when you look at that 1967 movie, it's easy to think the apes wiped out the humans, but actually the humans end up wiping themselves out. And so I think it's sort of holding a mirror up and saying, hey, humans, you are so stupid and you will do things at your own peril without thinking through about the consequences. So to me, it's a nice sort of... Even if we don't end up getting a Charlton Heston type remake, to me, this was very smart in the way that it gets us to that point.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with that.
Yeah, and to talk about Andy Serkis, my God, give the man an Oscar. He's incredible.
I don't know, have any of you seen any of the behind the scenes footage?
I saw one little clip.
I really encourage you and anyone listening to the podcast to go check out. Just type in Andy Serkis, Planet of the Apes. You'll come up with a ton of material. But to hear the man talk about motion caption acting and what he has to do to himself physically to walk like an ape, he thinks very deeply about his craft. And I think it's very easy to dismiss what we were seeing here as CGI, but actually it's not. It's performance art. And it's performance art aided by computers, and there's all this debate about, you know, should it be a new category of acting or whatever. I think it's just fine acting, and it's augmented by technology, but this man really understands it. It's not puppeteering, it's something else.
No, I'd be perfectly happy if he was nominated Best Actor. And, you know, we often give these nominations for somebody who's worked very hard. Well, Natalie Portman learned how to, you know, how to do the ballet. And so let's give her a nomination for, you know, Black Swan. But it was more than that. I didn't care that she knew how to do the ballet. It's what I could see on her face.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. The Caesar character, it's what you see on his face, which is incredible. And in his eyes. And he's kind of the soul of the whole trilogy, and rightly so. And I think especially this entire movie, it took me a while to realize that this is it. There were not going to be any other human characters, that this whole movie was going to be about Caesar.
Yeah.
And it took some getting used to, some recalibration in my mind, and then I was okay with it. But that's a lot to put on his shoulders, and, you know, he comes out very good. It does completely amaze me that you know, when you see like Caesar walking, he's not walking like a human. He's walking like an ape. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, apes,
their
center of gravity is much closer to the ground.
I knew that from the animation you were doing, Yasti, with your arms here.
Yasti's being very ape-like here in the studio.
So clearly it's not Andy Serkis walking. It's something which has been done to him walking so that it looks like that can't be him because
there is a great YouTube of him getting off the horse where his legs are bandy.
So it is him, and this is what's the magical about it. I mean, they change his proportions using CG.
Oh, okay.
He wears heavy weights around his wrists so that he gives his arms the added weight that an ape's arms might have. And he thinks very consciously about how an ape might move itself posturally. So
I wish we had a video taping this. Joe was trying to be an ape.
I was doing all the ape-like movements. Of course, they correct body proportions, but his cadence, his whole physicality, he is embodying. The movements that we see on screen are his movements, and that's what's kind of magical about the way he does this.
I think the only other thing I wanted to mention while we were talking about acting is I think they really were smart to choose Woody Harrelson, you know, to play the baddie here. And I don't know. It was a very complex kind of layered performance. Again, it reminded me of Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. You know, this person who's completely gone to seed and kind of detached himself from reality and has his own little, you know, little army created in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, he rules over it. And again, I saw a lot of Brando in that. But, you know, Woody Harrelson is so good here. I think, again, he as an actor doesn't get enough credit, you know, and he's... and I love, it takes a, not to give, maybe that's a spoiler, but I love what happens to him. It's not your typical bad guy's, you know, arc at all. So that takes a lot of gumption as well. So
I admired the performance, but I think I struggled with that storyline a little bit because I think it was, again, it was a little bit of a stretch for me where and how they took him. But I mean, again, let's not get too much into the spoiler territory.
For me, he felt a little bit cliche, like in, you know, a baddie in any superhero movie that we've seen of recent times. But yeah, I don't fault the performance. It was a good performance. So let's wind this one up. Yazdi, why don't you go first?
I appreciate this movie a lot. I admire it a lot. It's some kind of a technical breakthrough for sure. Andy Serkis does an amazing job. 7 out of 10. I wish this movie did more for me. It's not just this movie. The whole series kind of always seems at a distance from me, and it's something to do with me and not anybody else.
So ignore Yasti's score. Joe.
Yes, ignore my score.
Perhaps it was a weight of expectations here because I really did enjoy the first and especially the second in this franchise. So I came away just a little disappointed. It felt, you know, this was for me supposed to be the big war movie. And we had battles in the second one. So I went in thinking this is going to be bigger and bolder and louder. And instead, it's a very personal journey of a single character. So, you know, for that reason, it left me feeling a little dissatisfied, a little, you know, fizzled out. So I'm going to give it a very stingy 7 out of 10. I think it's a very accomplished movie. I think it's one that I'll probably think about and revisit for sure. Because I think, you take away this expectation of that I had, and maybe, you know, we got what you experienced, Rashmi, which was, you know, you went in with low expectations. I remember that.
Yeah, so remember, this is called War for the Planet of the Apes, not War of the Planet of the Apes. Subtle. So this movie won the war for me. This was magnificent. That's the only word I can think of that describes the experience of watching this movie and how I felt afterwards. So easily a solid 8 out of 10. Almost gave it a 9, but just shy of a 9. 8 out of 10.
Okay. Great. Let's move on to movie number 2 of the week then, Wish Upon.
Wish Upon, indeed. So the director of the horror movie Annabelle from last year, which itself was followed the same characters as from The Conjuring. So the same director, John R. Leonetti, returns with another horror flick called Wish Upon. It stars Joey King, Ryan Phillippe, and Ki Hong Lee. And the tagline for the movie is as follows, that a teenage girl discovers a box that carries magic powers, but with it comes a deadly price for using them. So this was a horror movie. I stayed the hell away from it. So you guys saw it. Tell me it wasn't scary.
Yeah, the problem with this movie, and I'll start by saying this movie has a lot of problems. The major problem with it is that it's a horror movie that's not at all scary.
I mean,
it's trying to be, but I think it's also aiming for a certain rating so that it can, a PG-13 mm-hmm. rating. And there are very frightening PG-13 movies out there, but this movie relies on a couple of boo gotchas, and they're not even that effective. That said, the movie has a little sweetness, I think. It reminds me of our heroine, played by, I think, was it Joey King?
Joey King, yeah.
Who was in The Conjuring.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She reminds me of the imperfect protagonist in Drag Me to Hell. And she has a sweetness about her because of her stupidity, and she doesn't always make the best choices. And so I thought the movie was kind of sweet at its heart. It's been butchered in the press here with a 20% Rotten Tomato rating. And I think that's again, it's a little heavy-handed for a movie that's really going for a teen audience. It's trying to be somewhat fun and not too scary so as to cause nightmares.
It just seems like such a retread, right? It's a box now.
It is.
Or it's a mirror, or there's some malevolent force which comes out of some object. I mean, they really need to get past that. But anyway.
So I'll almost repeat what Joe said. This is not a frightening horror by any means, although there are some gruesome deaths. This is, you know, Sinbad meets Final Destination meets Mean Girls. And I think the very smart thing about it,
Sinbad? I've got to say,
you know, like Sinbad the Sailor lamp or the number of wishes. You know, I think the very smart thing about this movie is, A, I think it makes you empathize with the main protagonist because of her circumstances. And who wouldn't wish all of those things that she wishes, especially when you're at high school? So I think automatically I found myself thinking, okay, she's stupid, but I would totally wish that as well. You know, you just would.
Right.
I think it's a really fun and enjoyable movie for a horror, but it's not really a horror. Not a typical one.
No, it's barely even a thriller.
Yeah.
It's
This is a great late night, like it could be a cult movie,
I think. It's a date night movie for 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
I mean, that may be what they were going for here. And it's a high school flick.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, apparently the director is better known as a cinematographer than a director.
Mm.
Although he did direct one of my other guilty pleasures, which is Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Well, that's quite a
so
height.
So I felt akin to him.
It's height.
I mean, look, I can wind this one up. I haven't really got much more to say about this. Joe, have you got much more to say about this one?
No, I mean, go ahead.
Look, this is a really fun, watchable movie, and I love the ending, and I wish Yazdi would watch this.
Really? No, you don't.
Look, I think it's easily a 7 out of 10. I really enjoyed this. It's really fun. It's a fun, silly, enjoyable Saturday morning, rainy day. Watch and eat a donut and a big cup of coffee.
Okay.
In a blanket. You know, it's just a fun lose yourself movie.
I mean, I'm going to go with a 6. This movie is not a good movie. It's also not horrible. And I think it's, you have to understand that this movie for me feels like it's targeted at the quiet Twilight crowd. Targeted at the kind of, you know, the kind of
maybe
hormonal
tween,
high school teens. I think it's genuinely pulled its punches in terms of its scares, because there's an expectation here that, you know, 9-year-olds are going to be snuck in by their 13-year-old uncle to the PG-13 kind of thing. And
which is what happened at our screening.
Which is exactly what happened at our screening. And, you know, there's an underlying sweetness to the protagonist that I think, you know, makes the movie passable. So a very, very generous 6 out of 10.
Yeah. I'm sad to see Ryan Phillippe doing such crappy roles, though. I mean, not that I ever think he was a great actor to start with. And I think once he lost his, you know, A-lister wife.
Who was?
Reese Witherspoon.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I always liked him. He had a nice differentness. He wasn't like a typical...
Yeah. He's playing a dad. He's playing Joey King's dad in this movie. Yeah. I mean...
That's right. He's trawling through garbage for some bizarre reason. I never quite understood the plot.
To get us the wishing box.
Never really explained, so... All right. Let's move on then to the main event.
I guess it's time, ASD.
Yes, it's that time.
I guess we've got to give into this now.
The ones every 3 years.
Given he made us wake up in the middle of the night.
It is every 3 years. No, Interstellar was 2014.
Oh,
and The Dark Knight was 2011.
My, how time flies.
Yes. We will be sitting in 2020, no doubt.
All right.
Okay, so
go on, Dunkirk. Take us to Dunkirk.
So directed and written by Christopher Nolan. This tells the story of Allied soldiers from Belgium, the British Empire, and France who get surrounded by the German army and get evacuated during a fierce battle in World War II. So it's based on a true story and a true battle that occurred, and had a lot of bad press in the British Empire for that. So it stars Fionn Whitehead, Damien Bonnard, a ton of people, including Mark Rylance, Tom Hardy, Jack Lowden, Luke Thompson, and a cast of billions of extras. So, Yazdi, why don't you start off? Let's make Joe wait a little longer.
You're going to ask me to start?
Well, I don't know if I'll be able to break in once he starts. So, I figured you better get your...
Wow.
Or should we predict what his score will be?
Why don't you do that?
It's a 10. I guarantee it. I don't even need to predict it.
What did
Maybe
you think
nine.
Of it?
Go on, Yazdi. What did you think?
I think... I think Nolan is one of the best craftsmen when it comes to making movies. And, you know, he's up there with the Coen brothers and with David Fincher. He cannot make, and his craft seems to be exponentially becoming more ambitious. But I think what has dogged him in his most recent movies is this need for, you know, grander and more bombastic and more, you know, self-important kind of things. And I've always said that when he goes back to a smaller scale, he'll always be a better director. And considering that he was out millions of years in Interstellar last and going back and forth against time, I think this is a relatively more smaller story. It's certainly one of his shortest movies. And I really think it's for the better. I mean, this movie is 100 times better than Interstellar, 100 times better than any of the Batman movies, I think. I think just as a war movie goes, it will stand as one of the top 10 war movies ever made, if not higher. He just achieves, by virtue of the experience of sitting through what's happening, he achieves a kind of in-your-seat experience that you have not felt before, to give credit where it's due. So I think I'd be very surprised if it does not get nominated. I mean, finally, this is the movie which is going to get him all the nominations. He's best director, best movie, best production design, best sound design. It's going to get all this stuff come Oscar time. And it's going to be a hard one to beat in terms of the prestige. So I've said a lot, but I think it belongs with the best of Nolan movies, the smaller ones, which for me are Prestige, Memento, and now Dunkirk. And we can talk more. I liked it.
Rush me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
You may not shut me up once I get started.
Oh, okay. So I was going to say, this is a really good VR experience ride at Universal Studios that will make you believe you are a soldier at Dunkirk. I admire it. I marvel at how it's been put together, but it's more like a public service announcement with very little dialogue. I know at its core it's an effective survival movie. Could I sit through it again? Definitely not, Joe. But it's worth seeing on a big screen, although wear earbuds to protect yours.
What, your ears?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you like it?
Yeah, did you like it? Because I can't tell from that commentary.
I didn't hate it. I didn't like it for the sense of being a narrative story, but I admire it and I marvel at how it's been put together.
And what do you think my score is going to be?
9.
No, it's going to be a 10.
All right, here goes. So it's funny because...
Joe, tell us what you thought.
I mean, yeah. I don't think a single podcast goes by without one of you two poking fun at my complete...
And how many reviewers, when we sat down, said the same thing?
And so, you know, I have to admit, I'm something of a sycophant when it comes to Nolan's work. And, you know, Dunkirk did not disappoint. It's interesting, the build-up to Dunkirk has been... kind of low-key. I think it's not been hyped as much as some of his other movies, and I was a little, you know, concerned that this is supposedly a true story. All of Nolan's previous works have been works of fiction. This is the first time he's done anything that is, you know, based on fact. And yes, you're frowning there, but...
No, so we see certain characters in the movie who are followed through the length of the movie. Are those based on real stories?
They are fictional characters.
Okay. So, but the setting is very real.
Setting's real, gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I should be very clear.
No. I wasn't sure, so that's why I was asking. Okay.
So, I was somewhat concerned going in that this might not be, you know, this might be more cerebral. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, war movies tend to be kind of very talky hero's journey. What we got here was just an amazing, amazing spectacle of, and I know it's going to be too loud and brash for some, and I think too emotionally light for others and too action oriented. But honestly, I think this is a very, very clever approach to a war movie. I don't think we've seen this before where essentially the movie dispenses with Act 1 and 2. And we go straight for the finale. And then we are in the finale for 2 hours. And, it does the kind of thing that Nolan can seemingly only do, where we have 3 separate timelines layered into one narrative. In many ways, you know, if you look at Inception, how we had the different timescales all interwoven but happening at the same time. You know, Dunkirk does the same thing. It's his same idea, and he's the only director that I know that tries to do this and can do this. So, it's one hell of a movie. It's more experiential. It's not talky in the way that most war movies are about a hero, right? Somebody does something, you know, prevails, difficult circumstances. You know, we saw Hacksaw Ridge last year, you know, Saving Private Ryan. They're all stories about an individual soldier or a group of soldiers who prevail. This story doesn't really lend itself to that. If you know about the history of Dunkirk and what Nolan does here is he puts us on the land, he puts us on the sea, and he puts us in the air, and we see the crisis that was Dunkirk. We live that crisis. We're beaten to a pulp by the Zimmer score and the visuals, and what a treat it is in the right movie theater. This is not a home movie. Don't watch this on an iPhone ever. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, so that was predictable. But anyway, you did say some good things in there. I mean, I agree with you, Joe. I think it's more like The Pianist versus Schindler's List when you talk about the Holocaust, in terms of it's definitely something we're going through with the characters as opposed to about a great story that's unfolding.
Think of it like Son of Saul. Do you remember that movie from a year or two ago about the Sonderkommando?
Yeah.
That was a very experiential movie.
But I think my I've got 2 criticisms of it. One is it's like the beginning of Saving Private Ryan for the entire movie. Yeah. So again, if you like that beginning, landing on the shore, that's the entire movie, I think. And then I think he missed an opportunity to tell the story of the ordinary people with boats who saved thousands of men when their country decided not to.
You didn't get that from Mark Rylance's journey?
I did, but he ended up being someone who knew a lot about boats and being in the army. And he knew what every missile was and every plane was. And that's not an ordinary person. That's a person who's lived that experience going back to save his countrymen. I wanted to know about the ordinary people who felt so passionate that they took their own weekend boat and decided that they were going to make that crossing at their own peril to save soldiers. So that's my only criticism. I think he had an opportunity to do that because there haven't been many stories about Dunkirk. And I think that we got more about the narrative of Dunkirk as a war, as a battle, from Their Finest, from the movie that came earlier this year, the one with Bill Nighy and...
Yeah, Gemma Arterton.
Yeah. So I think it's a very niche movie. It's very focused. I agree with you that it's a different treatment of a war movie, but I wouldn't call it a war movie per se.
I think it's a question of scale. I mean, you could do the more traditional epic, and that's the movie I was expecting. I didn't know anything about Dunkirk other than, you know, that, you know, so many 100,000 soldiers were evacuated from, you know, from France while they were being, you know, relentlessly pursued by the Germans. That's the extent of what I knew, and I kind of was lost through much of the movie because it does not give you any explanations. It just drops you in the middle of that, and you have to figure out who's good, who's bad. I didn't understand half the time why certain people were being attacked and so forth, and that's fine. It's meant to be a very visceral experience for you. But I was looking for the climax of this movie to be the rescue of these hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and he deliberately chose to not have the movie be about it. He deliberately chose for you to know about Dunkirk through the eyes of these three or four characters. I like smaller Nolan, so I'm not complaining about it, but I think there is another movie to be made about this heroic, you know, exodus of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in these small boats. And you don't see that here, which is fine.
Yeah. And I think I agree with all of those points. I think therein lies, you know, the director's choice, right? This is, they have to make a movie. This is, if you think about the way that many other filmmakers may have approached his story, we would have gotten all of those ingredients. And I think instead what Nolan was trying to do was something new. And this is the kind of filmmaking that he does, right? This is, you know, the idea that we can, you know, be placed in the battle, in, you know, in the moment, to see what it would have been like for these individuals, to see what it would have been like, to see what the whole, you know, did you not get the sense of the whole mess of it all? The fact that they were stranded, that they were abandoned, that they, it was poor planning, that there was no boats that could get them there, that they were defeated by the enemy, and that they snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. I mean, did you not get any of that from this movie? Because that's exactly the movie that I got, that these guys were screwed. They were stuck on this beach, and the Germans were essentially had got them beaten. And this could have been a pivotal moment in World War II where, you know, things could have gone so horribly wrong with 4,000 deaths, or what would have more likely been the case of surrender. And did you not get the sense that this was a mess? And that the bravery and the individual experiences and the people like the Mark Rylance character came to save them? I mean, I got all of that. I'm not quite sure why you didn't why you didn't feel that journey, because I think it's all there, and it's there in a way that's very emotionally powerful for, you know, somebody like me who likes to have this kind of sense of urgency filmmaking there. I mean, this movie, it's breathless.
Yeah, I mean, go on. I mean, I got a sense of, you know, I think this is what the best war movies do, is they kind of reinforce your views on war no matter where you stand.
Right.
You know, and I think you can see this as, you know, a heroic battle for doing what's right, or you can see this as the complete horrible nastiness that is war, depending on where you stand on the political spectrum. And I think the movie did a good job with that. And I think, for better or for worse, I think it just follows those, you know, those characters, the two characters. Maybe I'm giving too much away, but there's somebody on sea, there's somebody, a couple people in the air, and there's a few people on land, and it kind of follows them through, and kind of through their journey, you kind of make what you will of that particular war situation. So I see how it's a missed opportunity for opening up the scope a little bit and kind of being about Dunkirk. This movie's not about Dunkirk. It could have been about any war. But I think in some ways, at least what happens with the people on land kind of reminded me of The Revenant, because it was so relentless. It was so absolutely relentless. Like, these guys don't catch a break. It's like one thing after the other, where after a while it was like, it was just, you know, this seemed like too much of a contrivance. Come on, nobody goes through this after this after. That's why I was asking, was this based on a true story? But it doesn't matter, because he's such a good craftsman But each of those scenes, I mean, you know, your seats shake and the screen rumbles. And I mean, like The Revenant, I was constantly telling myself, how did you do this? Mm. How did you film this? How did you do that? I mean, there are ships sinking, and there is, you know, there's this amazing scene where the character is on the face of the soldier, and in the distance you can see explosions happening, like coming towards him. Maybe it's CGI, maybe they did it and timed it perfectly. So it's, I mean, this, nothing about this is sloppy or
phoned
in. Not half a second of it.
So Joe, I can see that you're very passionate about this movie, and I wish I had got that passion from this movie. I didn't. I saw this very much as a movie about survival.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. That's all I saw. It's a movie about people having to survive.
And that's a large part of the story of Dunkirk.
Right. And who are desperate to survive. And that feeling of not surrendering and defending our land and defending our sea, that didn't come till, you know.
There. That's not part of the story of Dunkirk.
Right. But I didn't see it as what you said.
This was a disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
And so survival was the key.
Yeah, but I didn't. It didn't get under my skin. It didn't make me feel. I didn't feel anything. There were no real characters to feel for. There was no one to side with. There was no one to root for. There was no one's arc. It's just an experience of being in the land, being in the sea, and being.
I'll concede to that.
In the air. So I think, again, I go back to. I think if you are looking for the movie, which is the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, then this is that movie. I mean, I think the gimmickiness.
That's what I said at the beginning. I mean, this movie is a grand finale. It's that's all it is. It starts at the point at which most stories would finish, and then just deals with that for 2 hours.
Yeah. I also thought it was trying to be a little bit too clever by having the little Tarantino-esque chapters.
Yeah, it took me a while to figure out.
The mole, 1 week, the sea.
One day,
the air, 1 hour. I just thought, okay, yeah, but it didn't add anything.
Wait. It was three narratives.
I know it was. Yeah.
So there's three narratives interwoven.
But
I know.
So it was just telling us that that's what it was doing. So the story in the air is an hour.
Joe looks like he's defending the movie.
I don't think it was Tarantino-esque in terms of dividing it up into chapters. It was just telling us that we're getting three narratives here because this isn't an A to B movie.
Right.
And we see the same scenes replay from three different perspectives.
I just didn't. It didn't add anything.
You heathens!
No. It came off a little precious.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a tad precious. But I love.
Joe, you didn't make this movie.
No. Wait a minute.
Joe, you didn't write this movie. Joe, you directed. Okay, you have nothing to defend it for.
No. I love. Okay. See, you have no idea how much it pains me because I think Nolan is easily the most overrated filmmaker right now. But this might be his best film, really. You know, as far as I'm concerned, and I, you know, just like you said, just like in Inception, just like in, you know, he's playing with time. It's his favorite thing he loves to do. And here again, he's playing with time in terms of three events. One's happening in a week's time frame, another's happening in a day's time frame, and another's happening in an hour's time frame. I got that. But those placards, those little things which came up, those were not, maybe they should have rewritten it. It looked weird, like the mole, 1 week, two, the sea,
one day.
I mean, it does. It just comes off like, well, you know, you won't understand it, but you'll figure it out later.
And that was the point I was going to make, is I think it was a concession, because I think Nolan does this to us all the time, right? He drops you in the middle of a situation, and he doesn't really care whether or not we're going to get it or not. It's up to us to put it together. We've said that before. We said it. We saw it with Inception. Inception is a very narratively, you know, constructively complex movie. This did that same thing. And I really feel that those placards, if they were there for anyone, it was like somebody at the studio is going to be like, we're going to have people walking out. They're not going to be able to figure out what the heck's going on unless we tell them at the beginning. So I think that...
But I didn't... It took... I didn't figure it out. I was like, what the hell is that? I figured it out eventually, but not in the moment.
I don't think it. Yeah. It wasn't a necessity. It just came off looking a little bit.
You're going to nitpick the placard.
I love the time.
You're
what's gonna it called?
Pick on me for placard to the next 3 years until the next Nolan movie comes along. And I'll give you that.
Can I say what really bothered me? And I think this
you
is
can
what
say whatever you want. Know, yes, it's your podcast.
They should have a warning at the start of this movie that no cellos were destroyed during the making of this movie. I mean, really? I mean, those cellos. It was like. Is there 5 seconds in this movie where the music is not blaring?
Tick, 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 tick.
Oh my
tick,
God.
Tick,
I was, you know, I enjoyed it initially. I was so thrilled by it because it's all percussive and it kind of builds.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't let go. It builds and then the next time it builds again. And then after a while, I was just sick of it. I was like, stop doing this.
This is Zimmer on steroids.
Zimmer needs to take
like 5 gallons of coffee.
Zimmer needs to take a Xanax, okay? He needs to take a full course of Xanax. He needs to chill down, dude.
Yes.
He really needs to chill down. Look,
everyone complained in Interstellar when he chilled out and played the pipe organ for a while. So he's back here with his drums and his cellos.
It's so good, but he should have used it judiciously.
Yeah, I think it does. It builds and it builds and it builds. And, you know, I read the production notes for it and they use this technique.
Of course you did, yes.
The shepherd's sequence where the music feels like it's always rising.
Correct.
And so that's the problem.
And it's so beautiful in the first half hour, and then it becomes an annoyance.
Well, and it's really loud.
And it's really loud.
I mean, there's like the sort of the build, but then it's like, I mean, seriously, I wish I'd worn those earplugs that you gave me, Jen.
Yeah, we saw it in IMAX, just so that everyone can kind of appreciate the fact that we were in...
Which I recommend. I think...
The biggest, baddest, loudest sound system that exists currently is in IMAX theaters.
Yes, and you should see it there.
And that is how this movie, I think, was intended to be. Because you are physically kicked around by the soundtrack.
Take your earbuds.
Yeah, and I don't... I mean, I won't complain too much because it's such an amazing piece of craft. But you don't need to be told on a minute-by-minute basis that now you should be thrilled. And now there's, you know, now this is the height of, you know, how intense this is going to get. You know, look at something like No Country for Old Men, which used no background score. And it's even more chilling, or as chilling as this movie is. So anyway, I mean, really, he needs to divorce himself from Hans Zimmer. He needs to go to like somebody else, somebody a little bit more restrained. I mean, I don't think
Thomas Newman.
He needs to go to somebody on a fiddle going ding 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 ding. But it's beautiful in the first half hour, and then it just. Anyway, I'm repeating myself.
I mean, some of the cinematography is incredible. There are these amazing scenes with hundreds of thousands of men. I don't know how they did that.
Yeah,
hundreds and thousands of extras, all with dark hair. Lots of young men with dark hair. I don't know how they found them all, but they all look the same to me.
Well, I mean, Nolan famously does everything in camera. So when you see a ship sinking, it's because they sank a ship. When you see a plane crashing, it's because they crashed a plane. When you see bombs going off by a soldier's head, it's because they set bombs off by a soldier's head. I mean, this is what he's kind of... This is the thing that he does because he feels that there's no way that CGI can convey those types of things. So they strapped like a hulking great IMAX camera to the side of a Spitfire. I mean, you know, this is kind of where they as filmmakers kind of get carried away with their craft. And it's on show in every frame in this movie. I mean, it's ridiculously well shot. Hoyt,
yeah.
He's going to get a cinematography nomination for this movie. There is the work.
The production design.
That was done in Nathan Crowley on production. I mean, you know, it's the same team. He always uses the same team. They're all people that get enormous resources when they work on a Nolan film, and they use them to excess. And so I think that's kind of what we see here. You know, IMAX is an amazing format. I don't know if you guys felt that in the movie, but the kind of the immersion just of the imagery, it was just... It's so perfectly well crafted. I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's a VR. It's like when you strap those glasses onto my head and tell me to look at a direction, and then these things come towards me. Right? What's that called?
Yeah, virtuality. Yeah, the Oculus.
It's like one. Yeah, it's like when you put the Oculus on my head. I mean, you know. Just one more complaint. One more complaint. Yeah, you don't want to know what our extracurricular activities are. just straps the Oculus to my head, and okay. Things come
too much information. Yeah.
You don't want to hear about the dinosaur yesterday.
Anyway, I mean, the other thing is, look, what little teeny tiny dialogue there actually is in the movie is so damn mumbly. But it's not about the dialogue, of course. It's about the experience and the look in people's eyes and their hunger for survival. It doesn't make it bad. It's just not the narrative story that I think most of us are looking for.
Sounded like a sum up, Rashmi.
Yeah. I mean, I found this quote from Churchill. Part of his quote after Dunkirk was over was, "We shall not flag or fail." That's the beginning of his speech. And, you know, Nolan doesn't flag or fail by any means. Nothing about this movie, as you said, it is phoned in. This is an experience movie. So know what you're getting. I will say solid 7 out of 10.
Yazdi.
Yeah, I mean, all the Nolanisms are here, but I think he's kind of found the right scale here. I really hope his next movie is even smaller than this one was.
Like in a cafe.
Maybe, yeah.
With Thomas Newman music.
Yes. But I really think, as war movies go, I have not seen one like this. I think just by virtue of spectacle and by virtue of indicating how terrifying in the moment it might be while you're a soldier, this movie kind of achieves something which hasn't been achieved in cinema, period. So I I'm not prone to hyperbole, so I'm not making this up. I really think we have not seen something like this in the cinemas before. So just
not even Battleship.
Not even Battleship, especially not Battleship. But I think just again, even if it's, you know, to the purpose of Nolan writing these characters going through one unimaginable hell after another, you forgive him that because the hell is so beautifully realized. So although I did feel bad for poor Tom Hardy, because just like in the Batman movie, he spends most of the movie behind a mask on his face, you
as
know?
He does in Mad Max, you know.
As I mean, he does in Mad Max. What is it with the poor guy? But
injections.
Clearly everyone feels that his eyes are enough for him to give us a performance.
Yeah. I also think the movie has a certain chill about it. I don't know how else to explain it. It has an emotional detachment almost, which is very weird because he has chosen to tell this story through what, 5 or 6 characters at, you know, at different times. So I expect it to be completely emotionally devastated. There is somebody who dies in this in one of the scenes, and it had no effect on me. I kind of felt, oh, he's dead. That's horrible. Well, okay, let's move on. Let's watch the rest of the movie.
And we did.
Yeah.
And we did. We just moved on.
So I think...
It's not a character movie. And I think...
But I thought this was a summing up. There was a precision. There's a cold precision to the movie,
Joe's, I think, like edging you back in. He's sucking you back in.
Sorry. So I think, honestly, I don't want to overstate things, but as far as craft goes, I don't think anybody's achieved this to date in the history of cinema. So as far as craft goes, it's a 10 out of 10. But I think overall, because I wanted this movie to kind of break me down into little pieces and give me a movie watching experience. And as terrified and torn by duty I felt that a soldier might feel, as a movie goer, it didn't move me. So overall, an 8.5 out of 10, which I'm going to back down to an 8, which is very stingy. It maybe deserves a 9. But not the 10 that you're about to give it.
Oh, all the 9.
Well, that was known as soon as they announced the title of the movie. So I'm not going to pretend that this movie is anything other than marvelous. I mean, this is the kind of filmmaking that only Nolan does. And this is the kind of filmmaking that I think is the reason that I go to the movies. It's a very physically exciting, you know, this can sound terribly sexual, that's not at all, but it's a very physically exciting movie for me. I mean, I was constantly in the moment on this, at the edge of my seat. It reminded me of those big moments in the action sequences in the Batman movies, which he does so well, that are just so exciting, and so you're so present. And I think that's kind of what I want to see in the movie theaters. This is my stuff. No, this is the kind of movie that, if I was a filmmaker, this is where I would want to get to. This is the kind of thing that, you know, is for me. So Perfect 10 out of 10. I think it's a very visionary movie that I think no other filmmaker can do right now. I mean, I just don't know anyone else that has got the technical skills to assemble this and to craft it so finely. I mean, think about the sound design, you know, alone. I mean, that first, in the opening sequence, when the gunshot happens, it's like where did that come from? It whizzes from behind you and explodes and it crackles and it's frightening. You don't know where to look. And all of that kind of stuff is very hard to do. We take it for granted because we see it so much in this movie, but every moment of this movie is crafted like that. And I think to place us there, the cups of tea being served on boats to people who are, you know, I mean, it's those little details that no one else seems to pick up on that give us that very real feeling. It's spectacular filmmaking, and I will see it again, Rashmi. I'm going to see it probably when you're out of town in IMAX in 70mm, because I think there's no experience like that that anyone else can craft right now.
So, Rashmi, it's not only going to be his top movie for 2017, also be prepared for 2018.
Until the next one comes along.
It was such a treat. And I was actually prepared to be disappointed for this one, which is interesting.
It's interesting. What you just said, though, Joe, reminds me more of a video game than a movie. And maybe that's why it appeals to you more, because you do like video games. So this doesn't feel much different than I imagine something like Call of Duty does, set in that era.
Again, granted, this is not an emotional movie. It's an experiential one. I think it places us there. And I think it is hard to get tied into the stories, because I think, you know, as much as we start to care for these soldiers, we never learn to love them.
But we don't even know their names.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's not the film that was written. This is a 75-page script. You know, this is not a 150-page script, which is what most movies are.
Not to get all political, but really, not a single female character in this movie.
They're serving tea.
I know this is a war movie. I know it's a very masculine movie, but still, there's. Like Nolan, next time, make a small movie, write a female character, maybe.
But this was not a female story.
I know, but he never writes
400,000 men on a beach.
I'm not talking about
his Catwoman was pretty cool. Anne Hathaway's Catwoman was pretty cool.
Okay, anyway. The other thing I want to say
is, you will not criticize this movie and get away with it, yes.
He was very, very... smart with his casting, I think, because his usual regulars are there, Cillian Murphy and Tom Hardy, etc. But kind of some of the lead roles are given to, unknown actors, and they really come through. And I think if I'd seen a Matt Damon in here, or, you know, even a James Franco or whoever, it would have pulled me out of the movie. I think the fact that these are unknown faces that you see kind of makes you resonate with, you know, how most soldiers are unknown, but still they're somebody's family and so forth. See, that was very, point. Very, very good of him to have done that.
I mean, we say that, but I think Mark Rylance, I think, has the best supporting in here.
He's great.
Because there's so much said without, said non-verbally by Mark Rylance in this movie. You know, he himself encounters personal tragedy. As part of this story arc, and again, I think is it good acting? Is it good direction? Is it, you know, what is it, good writing? What is it, you know, that gives us that connection to a character that we know so little about? I think there's a supporting actor nod in here for him.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, how long did we talk for?
We're up to 58 minutes, wrap this one up. We did cover three movies.
That's true.
This was not the Dunkirk podcast. We've got plenty more Dunkirk references to come over the next couple of years.
Yes, that's right.
Be prepared. Hold on to your chair, Rashmi.
3 years.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. So let us know what you thought of this movie, of these movies. Mail at movieworldlife.com.
Nearly let it slip. What did you think of Dunkirk?
Well, why shouldn't it just be honest? Twitter.com/moviewallers, facebook.com/moviewallers as well. Until our next podcast, too many movies, too little time. And goodbye from me.
And me.
Me as well.